Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Edwin Miller, Chief Product Officer at Aledade. Welcome, Edwin.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. And what I always like to do before getting into the main part of the discussion is to let my guests provide a little bit more of an introduction as to who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
Oh, thanks. So I'm one of the co-founders of Aledade. Our CEO is Farzad Mostashari, who was formerly the National Coordinator of Healthcare IT in the U.S. So he regulated the health IT industry, essentially. And when he left there, he and Matt Kendall, who had run the REC program within ONC, were thinking about what to do next. And they were thinking about starting this new company. And they asked me to join them originally as the CTO. My background was I've been in healthcare since the early 90s and have built primarily EMRs, but probably 30 something different products in healthcare technology, mostly SaaS based products, ranging from EMRs to discharge planning systems to pharmacy systems and so on. And I came up as a programmer. I started out just being a developer and I was in all kinds of different businesses at first. And I landed in healthcare in the early 90s and found, I think a lot of people wake up or they're born thinking, I want to be in healthcare. I think for me, it was a job at first. But once I got into it and I started really getting to know doctors and seeing what they're actually trying to do to help patients, it became much more of a mission for me and much more of a thing that would get me up in the morning. And so I started out as a technologist and had various CTO roles for a while. And then I've moved from also VP of product in companies where I kind of moved more on the business side. And I think that over time, it's been all about interesting or innovative business models in healthcare, because there's, you know, the software industry in healthcare was pretty dysfunctional in the early days. It was very much a licensing model. And I just felt like, you know, I was at Athena Health, which was a very innovative model at the time, which was basically kind of taking a little bit of risk with their customers to get results. And I found that very interesting. Aledade is much further down that spectrum. And so what we do is we create ACOs and we build them around independent primary care physicians. We find them to be sort of the undervalued players in the healthcare system today. They account for 4% of the cost, but they have much greater influence over probably 85% of the cost. And so we found them to be our focus point in building ACOs around primary care docs. And so we go at risk with them. We form the ACOs in various markets. The physicians, we don't buy practices. The physicians stay in their practice. And they join the ACO and participate in that alongside their existing fee-for-service work. And this is a good way for them to make this transition, which is pretty scary and filled with ambiguity, to be honest. And it helps them have some confidence that they can get there at their own pace and we can meet them where they are and help them with the services that we provide. So it's a really strong, I think an innovative business model. ACOs are a business model, and then we have a business model around that, where we make money when they make money, essentially. So we're fully at risk with our providers on the risk contracts that they take.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the emphasis that you put on forming ACOs around primary care physicians, since it feels like a lot of the early ACOs and arguably still a bunch of the ones that are being formed now seem to be more hospital centric. So, you know, kind of building off of I think what you said about the fact that primary care, I think you said, accounts for 4% of the spend, but has influence over somewhere around 80%. You know, kind of what drove you to focus on having physician-led ACOs, and how have you seen thinking about that evolve since you first kind of pushed that model?
Yeah, that's a good question. So physician-led ACOs, if you look at the studies that have been done around ACOs, physician-led ACOs outperform all other ACOs. And independent physician-led ACOs are the strongest in terms of they're the least encumbered by conflict in making decisions that are right for the patient and that also may reduce costs. Just, I mean, big picture wise, the pie's got to get smaller in healthcare, right? Costs are escalating and growing at an unsustainable rate. So the pie's got to get smaller. That means that there's going to be winners and losers in this. So who, you know, if a PCP can go from 4% of the cost to 8% of the cost, but they can reduce 20% of the overall cost from the system, then they benefit from, they can capture some of the value they create by doing the right thing. The key thing for us, though, is really that the most trusted relationship in healthcare is between a PCP and their patient. If you get a call from, you know, your insurance company to say, hey, I heard you have asthma, how are you doing? You're going to be like, who are you and what are you talking about? But if you get a call from your primary care doc who you saw last week and he says, hey, you know, I saw something going on. You were in the ED and why did you go to the ED and how are you doing? That's a much different conversation and a much more trusted one. So we feel like, you know, the system is, you know, in this transition from fee for service, which is pay for volume, to pay for value, the primary care doc kind of sits, we use a waterfall metaphor. Primary care doc kind of sits at the top of the waterfall before people fall over the falls, and the rest of the healthcare industry is sitting at the bottom of the falls where people have fallen over, they've gotten sick, and now we'll spend any amount of money to treat the stroke once they have it, but we won't spend any money to prevent the stroke in the first place. I mean, that's the essence of this. And who's in the best position to catch those things early on while patients are still relatively healthy, or maybe they have a chronic disease, but keeping it from moving from a chronic disease into an acute episode, the primary care doc is in the best position to do that in the coordination with the rest of the healthcare system, but they can function as the quarterback. That's our bet. And that has not changed since we started the company over 5 years. And now with, you know, roughly, you know, we're approaching 40 ACOs, you know, for 2020 and that kind of thing. So in terms of startups, a lot of startups have these windy paths, you know, and I've been in some where you have to pivot or you like your original thesis doesn't pan out. Alliday's been one of the most straight lines I've ever seen, where the original idea around building ACOs around independent primary care docs has really not changed. And we found, you know, great demand for this, both from the docs, obviously, and also from payers, and, you know, from taking risk contracts and performing well in them.
Yeah, no, that would seem to be kind of a natural outcome if, you know, you're willing to take on the risk that the payers would be on board with that. You know, I've seen that with my own clients who have kind of been on the vanguard to some degree of risk taking. And it's, you know, you might have some, you know, hard negotiation over the specific terms of an agreement, but the more that the provider or the physician group is taking on and kind of shifting away from the insurance company, it's kind of view it as we'll just collect the money and parcel it out and make a little bit of a profit off of it. And then you're doing all the work, which is kind of a nice setup.
Yeah. And we, you know, early on, we kind of had to pick who is our main customer, and our main customer is the PCP doc. And so we don't want to represent ourselves as like a payer representative to them, because we want to, our focus and our whole company is built around helping practices transform to this. And that includes, it's not just technology. It's, in fact, technology is important, but it's not even the main thing that we do. It's, we have field staff that go out every week and visit a practice and help, you know, these could be small practices in rural areas in the Southeast, all the way to inner city Manhattan and large FQHCs and so on. And so we have folks that go out, most of the employees at Alliday are out in those markets calling on practices every week and helping them answer questions and make this transition. We also have medical director, clinical staff that are helping to coach physicians on kind of what is a good wellness visit look like, or what does it really mean to do these things well? Not just checkbox medicine, which is what happens a lot of times in these compliance-based contracts.
You know, that kind of true partnership that you're describing seems like it would be extremely beneficial, because, you know, I think as you're suggesting, you can't expect physicians or really anyone who has been operating in one manner for years and years to be able to pivot on a dime, but to be able to provide support and your practical demonstration in terms of how to implement these new ideas or to pursue new avenues of care delivery is very helpful.
Absolutely. And it takes time. And I think, you know, there are, in the first year that we did this, we had two ACOs that we built, and we really went into it. This was probably the part that maybe wasn't a straight line, where we thought, we're going to go in and we're going to focus on specialist costs and hospital costs, and we're going to do all these things. And it's just, you know, no one's ever scrutinized this stuff before. And just by paying attention to it, it's going to get better. Well, it didn't. You know, it turns out that everything that we did that reduced utilization caught the system adapted, and costs found a way of going up in another place. And so we had, you know, in one of our ACOs in the first year, we had reduced ED utilization, reduced hospitalization utilization, reduced everything, and costs went up. So why was that? You know, it's, you know, because hospitals in that area got better at coding certain things, and it wasn't like they had an increased incidence of things. It was just that they were getting better at getting paid for it. And so it's really, you know, the system, don't underestimate the fee-for-service system and its ability to, respond to stimulus in cost savings efforts.
Yeah, actually, I kind of want to pick up on, I think, the first part of your answer there, which is, you know, this change takes time. I feel like you see a number of stories that question the premise of the ACO model because there has not been as fast of a shift in the system or as quick adoption as might be expected. So, you know, I'd kind of like you to expand more on, you know, what a reasonable time frame might be before you actually start seeing, you know, major systemic change or material change from pursuing an ACO.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's 2 to 3 years. Which in the MSSP world, that's one contract period. We thought, you know, there was an article out there from recently a. Like a study that was done that said that some of the savings in ACOs was done by sort of optimum selection of physicians or exiting high cost physicians. And we found a lot of issues with that study. And there was a rebuttal, I think, published by Harvard, which was worth checking out. But what we found is that in the studies largely are that ACOs are saving money, but not all ACOs are saving money. And if you happen to save money in the first year of a contract, it probably doesn't mean you're super awesome, to be honest. It probably means that you had, you know, a good benchmark or you had other things going on. It's a very complicated process, and this is why it takes time. But what Alidate has found is that even in year one where we had good luck in some ACOs, that the Alidate effect of going in and working with practices and having them focus on, you know, transitions of care, risk adjustment, value-based concepts, doing wellness visits, taking good care of your patients, knowing where your patients are, those are the things that get results over time. And we have found all of our cohorts, you know, as they go through the process, year one, two, and three, that in year one, whether or not they do well, in years two and three, they tend to improve a lot, and then they're usually making savings at some point in that contract. You know, sometimes, and it does require physician engagement. And so if there are practices in the ACO that are not engaged, then, you know, that's not going to go well. And so they may exit out. But remember, one of the things in the study about exiting physicians is that if a physician wants to stay in their practice, their practice is in the ACO for that year, whether they want to be or not, once they sign up for it. So there's no, you can't really just pick and choose, at least within a year, and then get results within that year that way. Anyway, not to digress too much, but I think some of this comes from the original premise that you raised, which is that a lot of ACOs were hospital driven, and a lot of people associate ACOs with health system led efforts. But if you look at the physician led ACO cohorts, they've been pretty successful. But it takes time to change this stuff. Fee for service is the original sin of healthcare. I like to say it's like the thing that is in our mindset so deeply that we don't even know it's there. And physicians have made their living this way for so long that starting to think outside that box, it takes time, and it takes time to habituate new workflows in the practice, to think about differently about goals, which we help with. And it's also really hard. You need a lot of data. You need a lot of analytics behind it, which is where you need someone like Alidate to kind of help guide you through it if you're an independent primary care doc.
Yeah, no, and those are very fair points. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Edwin Miller from Alidate, and we're talking about ACOs anywhere from startup through operation. And I want to pick up on something you were just talking about, Edwin, about, you know, the fact that, you know, the ACO model and really all of the value-based care models are about transitioning out of fee-for-service to a more quality focus. And I don't know if you have any information or data around it, but while these ideas are generating a lot of attention and review, you know, kind of for a prototypical group that you might be working with, how much of their reimbursement stream has gone over to the ACO or to value as opposed to remaining in fee for service?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's going to be highly variable based on patient panels and sort of contract mix within the practice. So I don't know that I have a clear answer for that. It's certainly less than 50%, you know, by and large at this point. You know, one interesting thing we've seen is that there are what I would call sort of good fee for service services, at least within Medicare, things like transition of care visits, AWVs or annual wellness visits, things like that, chronic care management. And so those are codes that you can bill in a fee for service model, but they're for work that you're doing that really is leading to value. Because when you're doing a wellness visit, you're doing a, you know, a bunch of screening, you're risk adjusting the patient, you're thinking through kind of the overall plan for the patient. And it's a time to think about what's going on with the patient as opposed to an acute episode where the patient comes in for a specific problem or something like that. So those there is some bridging there. And so we've seen a lot of increase just in fee for service revenue from practices focusing on this. But the question is, you know, most practices have limited capacity. And so it's a matter of who are the patients that I really need to put my arms around and focus on? And that's more of an analytics question, which is where we help them.
Yeah. And actually kind of, I guess maybe expanding on the analytics point, do you find that practices have a sufficient data set to be able to perform those analytics and be able to start diving into where attention might be needed? Or is that also part of the transition, the development that the practices need to be trained up on which data or what data to kind of gather from patients or to try and pull in?
Yeah, I think that that's an underestimated part of all of this. Look, I mean, our CEO regulated the health IT industry. I've built 5 EHRs. I have many people on our team who know EHR data really well. We have an EHR team actually that goes after the practices and helps them optimize their EHR. So we work with like 70 different EHRs. So one of the premises that we had was we want the best docs and practices, and we don't want to have to then transition them to another EHR because that would be really disruptive for them, especially while they're trying to do all this value-based stuff. So the data problem, we made the problem harder for ourselves so it would be easier for our practices. And at first we thought the data acquisition, especially from the EHR, would be pretty easy. And it turns out that we were really mistaken on that. Data portability is not real, and it's still a struggle. It's still pretty expensive. And I think this is an area where the industry, you know, and the government can step up, and this work is in process, but it's still going pretty slow. And I think, it's critical to value-based care. You have to know, you know, data blocking from hospitals is a problem. You need to know that your patient went to the ER last night. You need to know that your patient was discharged yesterday. You need to have sort of data fluidity across the community to make these things work so that people have the right data to make the right decisions. And so we spend a lot of time gathering data from different sources and then mashing it up, making it useful for analytics purposes, to prioritize patients, to do all the things that you have to do around value. I mean, value-based care is kind of doing the right thing with data and then making the right decisions and then applying good medicine to that and at the point of care. So it's none of this happens without good data flow. And so we've spent considerable amount of time on that. It made fair amount of bad assumptions along the way in doing that.
And with that point about, you know, wanting to make the right decisions to deliver good medicine, how is that defined? Is it defined by the quality metrics in a program? Is it defined by an industry standard, some mixture of the two, or something else?
Yeah, I'm not a physician, so I'm probably not super qualified to speak to that. But what I see with our docs is that this is very aligned with how they want to practice medicine. They really struggle with the fee-for-service kind of check the box, way of looking at things, and the way that payers are, look at what they do. And honestly, they want to take more holistic care of their patients. They want to call their, in population health, a lot of times, whatever the question is, the answer is you need to call your patient and talk to them. And so it's just, if they have a way to be, they can be compensated for that and that kind of thing, then that's aligned with how they want to behave anyway. I think the quality measures are important. But again, it can't be a check the box thing. It has to be, sort of like let doctors, there is standards of care, there's best practices that they follow, They just need to be brought to the table at the right time in the patient's journey to make that happen. And some of that can be data assisted. And some of that can be, or some of that is just an alert that, you know, the patient was in the ER. Why did the patient go to the ER at 11 in the morning when your office was open? Was that an access problem for your practice? Did they owe you money and they didn't want to pay you? What's going on? You know, and so having those conversations drives the right behavior. And a lot of primary care docs and docs in general want to do the right thing, and they would naturally do those things. But when they have an incentive to do it and they can capture some of the value of that, it becomes a much stronger workflow and a much more, sort of industrial strength, consistent workflow that they can do.
And you keep bringing up a very good point, which is, you know, wanting to avoid a check the box mentality, because, you know, I think it's very true that if you're focused on that, then you're not thinking holistically and not necessarily trying to reach the best conclusion. But one tension I wonder if it exists is, you know, if you've got an ACO that's participating in maybe two or more different programs. So, you had mentioned the MSSP, which is one of the Medicare programs. And given that commercial payers are increasingly pushing out these models too, is there overall alignment between all these different programs, or are physicians having to keep different standards in mind that even while they're trying to do the right thing, they still have to have this kind of overlying pressure of, you know, each contract might interpret how to achieve a measure differently?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we see our job as hiding that complexity from our docs. So we don't want them to have to think about what they do different for an Aetna patient versus a Medicare patient versus a Humana patient or something like that. So to the best extent possible, we want to sort of homogenize those quality measures or like a risk adjustment strategy, things like that, and make it be sort of like they have one workflow. They may need to answer different questions, or they may need to capture different data from time to time because the quality measures are different, but we want that to be as seamless as possible in the workflow. I'm not saying that we've totally solved that problem, but that's the vision of what we're trying to do. And so we if we can capture BMI on the back end on their EHR, and BMI contributes to multiple quality measures, then they can enter it once and we can reuse it multiple times on the quality measures and sort of just do the data architecture the right way there.
Yeah, no, and kind of using that example kind of brings up a pivot point. You know, we've been obviously talking a lot about, you know, the assistance to the physicians and the practices in terms of succeeding. But, you know, a piece that I always question is, you know, the physician could be doing all of the work that you're describing and doing everything well, but the patient isn't necessarily engaged in the process, which, you know, if they're not engaged, then no matter what the recommendation is, it can, you know, it could skew the results. So do you see any activities out there that are trying to make the patient a part of this discussion?
Absolutely. I mean, again, back to the sort of trusted relationship, that's the center of this. And it also brings in like social determinants kinds of questions and care management strategies, which is probably beyond the scope of what we're talking about here. But, you know, in short, I mean, and practices tend to have different strategies for that. But generally speaking, we want to support them in having a care management strategy of some kind. And whether that's a on-staff care manager, whether it's outsourced or something like that, or maybe there's, you know, mental health consultants that come in and can help with certain things. Those are definitely drivers of issues here. And so it's probably part of the care team strategy, I would say.
So, and to be able to support those care strategies, you know, obviously you need the resources, both, I think, human capital and actual monetary capital. You know, so is there a sufficient amount of money to be able to go around to really develop all of these programs, or is that a kind of a tension point?
Yeah, it's so there's multiple strategies that we've tried. So I would say there's probably more than one right answer here. Sometimes in a market, like in a rural market, Allidade has assisted help, you know, hiring a care manager that maybe supports multiple practices. Sometimes the practices hire that person themselves. So again, there's multiple ways to get that done, but they can accommodate it financially in a couple of different ways too. So they can either bill for it directly. The longer run, maybe less ideal way would be to try to capture, you know, savings from it, but that's going to take a while and hard to prove. But yeah, I think it's we've tried multiple things that have worked. Our practices continue to try different things. I wouldn't say that there's like one bright light in that respect.
No, and I think that's definitely fair enough. It's, you know, I think I would have been surprised if you said there was one magic answer, because that never seems to be how it works. But
we have seen that, like, doing our vision has been to push it to the edges where it's done at the practice level or close to it, that there's not some, you know, call center in the middle of nowhere that someone's, you know, where we're calling patients, you know, three states away or something like that. We have not, you know, that seemed like maybe not the best way to do it.
Yeah. And so amazingly, as we're already very close to the end of our time, I want to kind of ask one final question, which is a little broad, but, you know, just to ask where you see value-based care efforts going over the next couple of years.
I think it has momentum. I'm biased, of course, but I spend my every day in this. And I have been surprised at the amount of uptake from you know, Main Street physicians in this, and I've also seen, maybe surprisingly, broad support with this administration on this. So, despite all the things going on in healthcare, the world of MSSP value based programs in general has been continued to be supported and very strong. And I think it's inevitable that this is where, you know, that again, the pie has to get smaller. We've got to do a better job of this. And this is, and it is a model issue, a business model issue in healthcare. And that change is not going to happen easily or quickly, but I think it's kind of inevitable that we're going to wind up somewhere in this, you know, that looks like this.
Yes. No, I think it'll be safe to say it'll be a very interesting journey to follow. But, you know, as I said, believe it or not, we are already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Edwin Miller, for a great conversation today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's really great. Good questions.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at #HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.